Okay, good afternoon. So, earlier today, Primary Industries Minister David Carter announced that the National League Government will earmark an initial $80 million to assist with the development of important regional water infrastructure. The $80 million investment has been set aside in Budget 2013 for the establishment and initial stages of the company's operation to act as a bridging investor for regional water infrastructure development. The development of well-designed, commercial-scale storage and irrigation infrastructure has the potential to deliver significant economic growth for our primary industries and support new jobs, which will then have a flow-on effect for other New Zealanders. This was highlighted in a 2010 economic report, which suggested that going ahead with current proposals in areas like Hawke's Bay and Canterbury could generate an additional $1.4 billion in export receipts by 2018. It will also have benefits for the environment and recreational users. This investment is part of the National League Government's delivering on one of its four key promises this term, that is building a more competitive and productive economy that is capable of supporting more jobs and, of course, higher incomes. The principle behind the Government's commitment is to encourage private investors to participate in irrigation development. It's also another step towards unlocking the massive opportunities that more and better water infrastructure create for our country. New Zealand naturally has plenty of water. This is about managing it better for the economy and for the environment. The $80 million investment is part of the $400 million from the Future Investment Fund that the government signalled in 2011 that planned to invest to encourage third-party capital investment. A number of groups are already developing proposals for larger regional level schemes, and the government expects to consider at least one proposal in the next year. In terms of ministerial activity, and my activities for the rest of the week, tomorrow I'm attending the Ratna celebrations during the day, and then I head to Auckland for a celebration dinner for this year's Prime Minister's Youth Programme participants. The 100 young people who take part in the youth programme each year have overcome real challenges in their lives, and some have been on the edge of trouble, but all have made positive changes in their lives. I'm impressed by their attitude and determination to succeed. On Friday, I'll be giving my first speech of the year in Auckland. This speech will have a strong economic focus and will set out aspects of the government's busy programme for 2013. And just for noting, there's no cabinet next week, therefore there'll be no post-cabinet press conference on Monday. Can't have a post-cabinet press conference, so you don't actually have the cabinet. So the next one, of course, will be on Monday the 4th of February, next Tuesday. Tuesday after that, the House resumes for 2013, and I'll be giving my statement to Parliament. I'm not going to get into all of the different parts of that. What I'd say is the government has a confidence and supply agreement with the Māori Party. That was to provide stable government over this three-year parliamentary term. I'm sure that will be honoured. And whatever else they do is one point of matter for them. But I think, you know, Honi Hararua has made his position when it comes to the National Party very clear, and it's mutual. There's no love lost there.
Would you be happy for Peter Sharples to stay on as minister if he is defeated as leader?
Well, that's something we'd have to work through with the leadership of the Māori Party. If you think back to the precedent for this, that was Heather Roy when she was a minister, and there was a change in leadership. Or change in leadership of the ACT Party. What I said at the time is, you know, while as Prime Minister I reserve the right to obviously determine who's in cabinet and who's out, I also take strong guidance from the leadership of our confidence and supply partners. So if there was a change in leadership, then they may well have a view on the makeup of the ministerial warrants and who should have those. I've indicated that there'll be two for the Māori Party. So I think that would be up for discussion with that leadership.
So you would rule out working with a party that
was appointed. Well, it's not really so much that. I mean, he's effectively ruled us out. So, I mean, it's irrelevant what I probably think on the matter. I'm just saying it's, you know, the feelings are mutual. But look, in the end of the day, there's a lot of ifs, buts and maybes of all the things that you're talking about. I mean, my strong suggestion would be if they do something well, that may well be into the future, but I don't think it's going to affect this 3-year parliamentary cycle from 11 to 14.
How do you think about two guys comfortable in the ministerial
role? Well, as I said just before, I mean, my view is that I would take strong guidance from the leadership of the Māori Party, of who they want to have ministerial warrants. I did that as the leaders stand today, they're obviously Hitori Taliana. If there was a change, and if there was a change in recommendation, I don't see that as a showstopper. I've got faith in Tauira O'Flavel, but in the end, the leadership of the Māori Party is a matter for the members.
So you would have ruled out that Dr. Sharp will stay on as minister if he was pushed out as co-leader of the party?
No, what I said was I'd take guidance from the leadership, and if there's a change of leadership, then obviously I'd engage with the new leaders, because it's essentially the Māori Party that's formed a confidence and supply agreement with the National Party, and in good faith I deal with the leadership that's in place at the time.
Has Tariana Tullia contacted you? She has asked Dr. Sharples to stand down. Have you had any discussions with her given the governance arrangements?
In recent times, you mean, or in terms of her own position?
Well, relatively recently. I mean, it's obviously come to a head today. Sharple was saying that she has asked him to stand down.
Oh, sorry, in recent times, no, she hasn't contacted. But the last sort of real contact I had with Tariana was just prior to the announcement she made that she wasn't going to re-stand in 2014. Obviously, I'm very disappointed about that, but I can completely understand.
But obviously, I mean, I suppose Mrs. Tullia, with the expectation that she would remain on as co-leader, she would be the person or one of the people that you would be taking guidance from in terms of those ministerial roles?
Of course, you know, she remains the co-leader. So, look, at the end of the day, I mean, there's a lot of ifs and buts and maybes in this whole debate. And if there is a leadership challenge, as is indicated is likely to be, then I'll, like everybody else, wait and see what the outcome of that result is. Whenever we know that result, I'll engage with the leadership team, whatever that looks like.
Have you got any concerns about confidence and supply about the actual numbers?
No.
Any concerns at all about that arrangement
with
a change of leadership at all?
No, I don't. I mean, look, my view is that the Māori Party are good, honourable people. They've worked effectively with National now for the last 4 years. They made a strong commitment to come as part of our government and to provide a good, stable government for New Zealand. And I think they'll honour their commitment. And if there's a change of leadership, I don't anticipate any changes in the way that we operate. Of course, as I said, maybe changes in terms of the ministerial makeup, but not in terms of the nature of the relationship.
Because there has been a precedent too of Rodney Hyde when Don Bresch was leader outside the party, but he kept his ministerial role while he lost the leadership, so it's not necessarily out of scope that that could happen.
Well, that's right, it's not impossible for the Māori Party to have a leader that's not a member of parliament, and then by definition that person couldn't be a member of the executive, but they would be the leader of the party. And as was the case when Don Brash became the leader, I can't remember whether he actually had a discussion at that point about ministerial warrants very late in the piece, but you know, effectively it was a moot point because he couldn't have taken a warrant under those conditions.
Prime Minister, where to from here for David Bain issue?
Minister Collins gave Cabinet a really brief update about the process. There wasn't any conclusions drawn or a huge amount of debate undertaken. She simply indicated the next steps of the process that she's looking and embarking upon and agreed to come back to Cabinet with further recommendations for us. And she's likely to do that the next available Cabinet, which I think is the 4th of February.
Is it likely that another person will be appointed to inquire into the deal?
Well, they're all the sorts of issues that she's grappled with, that's exactly right.
So can you just outline what are exactly the next steps?
Well, she'll need to consider the process that now has to happen. I mean, so effectively, if you think about it, Rob Fisher QC didn't complete his report. He completed part one of his report, which was the critiquing of Binney's assessment of the situation. There's other work that he could do or another person could do, either domestically or offshore. So there's a range of different potential options, and she'll come back with some more advice in due course.
Are you ready for expense?
Sorry.
Are you concerned about the expense?
Well, look, at one level, obviously, you know, I'm always cautious with the expenditure of government money. So whenever people say, well, you know, the money doesn't matter, well, to a certain degree, that's always true and also was not true. So yes, of course, I'm mindful of that, but I'm also mindful of the fact that it's really important that this is done professionally and right, and this is a very high-profile situation. If you think about these kinds of cases in New Zealand's history, ones with this level of profile are, you can count on one hand. So money is important, but I think it's actually important that we reach a robust conclusion that New Zealanders can understand why we've reached that decision.
So are you saying a second review? Are you saying a second review is going to take place?
No, I'm saying she's going to come back with advice on what the next step is.
So is your review closed on the Billy report now? Is it that's shelved?
I think it's fair to say that the Minister doesn't feel confident to take a recommendation based on the Binney report to Cabinet. So in that regard, yes. And I think if you look at the work that that Rob Fisher did and his critiquing of that, my assessment of others' review of Rob Fisher's work is that they actually agree with what he's done. I mean, they're not finding fault in his legal arguments that he's presented about the Binney report. So I think in that regard, both the Minister has, well, I think the Minister's been vindicated in the steps that she took.
So logically, if that report is a redundant in terms of the government's view, there would have to be a second report, wouldn't there?
Well, most probably, but as I say, let's just run through the process of what happens next.
Prime Minister, on the irrigation investments, if they're going to be profitable schemes, why does the government need to effectively subsidise private investments?
Yeah, so it's a good question, and the answer is it's about the timing of these schemes. So it's in principle, if you think about irrigation schemes, they rely on a lot of small investors getting together at one point in time to provide the capital funding for the scheme. And obviously one way of forcing that would be to change water access rights for farmers who currently, for instance, might have, you know, free take and have no real need in their mind for irrigation. So it's never straight line. If you look at the Opua scheme, that was an example where we did manage to get a whole lot of people to agree at one point, but more often than not, you'll get farmers with at different points of the investment cycle. Some of them will be older, not wanting to take more debt on the farm, sort of happy that has a lower return but also has a lower level of investment. Then you have a lot of young new farmers who can see the financial returns over a long working period. So sometimes this is just a facilitation mechanism for allowing that investment to take place as people join, and more often than not people do join up to these schemes when they're there. So we think there's some real economic logic in them happening. The report we commissioned in 2010 supports that, and it's about facilitating that timing.
How is this different, though, from perhaps the government putting in seed funding for, let's say, a second optified cable?
Yeah, so in the case of the irrigation schemes, the intention is for them to still provide an economic return to the government. So there is an intention that there will be a return on capital, and that we will be effectively an investor that gets our money back. Now, obviously there are risks, but we're reasonably confident we can manage those risks. I think in the case of the Pacific Fibre cable proposal, that was kicked around extensively by officials, and I saw a number of reports from memory in relation to that proposal. And in the end, the view was it just didn't economically stack up, that there was lots of capacity on the Southern Cross Cable still existing, and that it was likely any new entrant was likely to meet with substantial potential price reductions, which would really challenge the viability. And to a certain degree, I think the government, again, has been vindicated in that view, because you had some very high profile, very high net worth individuals who went out both domestically and globally seeking funding for the Pacific Fibre Cable and couldn't get the investors. So what that tells you is they themselves were confident this thing actually economically stacked up.
Is that expectation of a return on the investment a new policy on behalf of the government? Correct me if I'm wrong, but I didn't remember when it was originally announced. It was seen by the government as a straight subsidy for no return.
No, I don't think that's right. I think certainly the view is we'll get our money back. We'll get much of a dividend back as another, on top of that, is another issue. But the expectation is it's literally is an investment, and that investment would be returned, and we would exit our investment in those projects.
I mean, so it's not an overpay. It's just something for us to understand. I was just wondering if you were concerned that it might not be easy to understand as well, and where people are coming from.
Well, I understand where they're coming from, but I think, let me say a few things. I mean, firstly, government has made it clear via the Ministry of Education that if there is a problem in terms of a school and the payment to those teachers, that we will make that school whole by ensuring that that funding is available for them, you know, immediately through their Ops grant. So no one should be actually be out of pocket. Some people can certainly be inconvenienced, and that's unquestionably been the case, and I accept completely the frustration. Secondly, no one wants to get the system resolved and the issues to go away more than we do, but this is a complex system that's clearly had some problems in its rollout. Personally, I would strongly advise not taking strike action. I mean, they can see by my actions yesterday that I'm taking it seriously. We're putting in the very senior minister to try and resolve these issues as quickly as we can, and I'm not quite sure what striking would do. I mean, you strike to get an outcome, and we're giving them an outcome, which is our most senior minister and a lot of focus of cabinet. Yeah, of course, we could rip up the scheme, but where would that leave us with no one getting paid? So, personally, I'd pull their heels if I was there. Well, I don't want to cut across what he's thinking because I haven't had any reports from him, any real update from him. But, I mean, look, in principle, we rely on New Zealand teachers being paid via that scheme. If it's not that scheme, then the question is, what system? And I don't have an answer to that question. So I think we're trying to resolve the issue as opposed to break it apart. But let's see where he comes back in the time.
But perhaps Helen isn't the right organisation for the job.
I wouldn't want to comment on that this morning.
Stephen just met with officials from the education
three
yesterday. Did he not give
Cabinet
an update?
No, not yet.
Was there
no
discussion about the issue?
No, not overpaid yet, no.
The financial deal, is there any idea as to any estimations
of
how much that could be?
I don't have an update on that number.
Prime Minister, the Bank of Japan yesterday announced unlimited money printing next year to devalue the yen.
Yeah.
As Tourism Minister, are you concerned about what that does for the New Zealand dollar versus the yen and the risk of global currency wars tip for tap money printing?
Well, first you've already seen a devaluation in the yen. I think that happened after the election. Closer following it than initially happened. Secondly, of course that's a concern if people are engineering a lower exchange rate through effectively fiscal easing policies. But I go back to what can New Zealand do about that, and any country that embarks upon printing money has to think fully through all the ramifications of that. Now, in the case of Japan, they've had very low levels of inflation. That hasn't been their problem for a very long period of time. But that's something they'd have to consider how they would manage that, just like the United States is. I still think from New Zealand's perspective, we're on the right path. I think printing money wouldn't necessarily see a devaluation in our exchange rate. And if you look in Australia, they've had quite a number of interest rate cuts in recent times. In fact, the exchange rate's appreciated, not depreciated. So there's not always a necessarily straight correlation. It's also been the case in the US. There's been a lot of different factors driving that. So look, in the end, it's a risk. But, it just sits in that whole basket of issues which are real out there, which is that the global economy is still not fully healed. And that is one of the risks that we face, that the US can't deal with its fiscal cliff issues, or that there are problems in Europe, or there's problems in Asia. And that's why, I think we're in better shape than probably we were in 2012 globally, but we're not out of the woods.
The Australian Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, announced that the national security strategy with a stronger focus on the region, countering terrorism and cyber security. Have you had any briefing at all about?
I think our officials were getting a briefing. I haven't seen that briefing yet. I'm sure my people will get me something overnight. In principle, we're singing from the same song sheet when it comes to cybersecurity. We think that's a real risk. You saw that work that was agreed, or that work program that was agreed between New Zealand and the UK when William Hague was out here. And we think that is a genuine area of risk for New Zealand.
Is there any competition alone, okay, sorry, we've been told that there are potentially hundreds of flaws or bugs in the system. Is there a chance that the system is so flawed that it cannot be fixed, that you will have to work on something else?
Well, there's always a risk. As I said yesterday, you don't know what you don't know, and there are potential unknowns in NovaPay. And the first thing that Stephen Joyce rightfully is doing is effectively getting a stock take of those and trying to understand them. I mean, at one level, there's been some real improvement. I mean, basically, the bulk of teachers have been paid, and things are sort of starting to calm down a little bit. Now, that hopefully is going in the right trajectory. But I just can't answer those questions yet because I don't know. If you come back in a week or so, I hope I'll have better information for you.
British Prime Minister Cameron has said that he would offer an in or out referendum vote for British voters to go out of the European Union.
Yeah.
Would New Zealand be concerned if Britain was to exit the European Union? What might that mean?
Well, it's a matter solely for them, and obviously, you know, we see the debate that's been waging there for quite some time. I mean, look, in the end, I guess the UK would have to decide whether they think they're better off being in or out of the UK, out of the European Union. It's not a straightforward decision, is it? I mean, a huge amount of their trading base is now with Europe. It has quite substantial implications, but it, as you can see, domestically, it's a pretty big hot issue, devolving more and more power to Brussels, and that's the conundrum that they face. I mean, from New Zealand's point of view, Britain is an important market to us, but it's nowhere near as significant as it was even a decade ago, let alone back before 1970. So, yeah, it's of some concern, but not major.
Can I just clarify one thing about the Manawari partnership?
Oh, yeah.
If that deal does go ahead, or if that partnership does go ahead for the next election, would that be a deal breaker for your relationship with the Manawari?
Well, like I say, there's so many if, buts, and maybes, but if you just go back to the most fundamental principle, if you're talking about Honi Hararira, he's put it in the plainest language as he can, that he doesn't want to deal with National, and as I've said, the feelings are mutual. But, you know, let's just sort of see how all of these things play out. There's water to flow under that walker.
So that sounds like a deal breaker, though?
Oh, well, like I said, it's a... Okay, to Luke.